Get ready for a little surf and turf action on Midnight Run Through, a podcast miniseries devoted to celebrating the 1988 contemporary classic action buddy comedy Midnight Run, written by George Gallo and directed by Martin Brest. Co-hosted by me, One Heat Minute Productions' Blake Howard.
And me, Jen Johans from Watch with Jen.
Each week, we'll explore the film we first bonded over when we became friends in 2019 by surfing through an incredible roster of guests from journalists to novelists and beyond who love it as much as we do. Digging into Serrano's finances and Alonzo Mosley's FBI files, come with us on Midnight Run Through as we crisscross the United States with the characters played by Robert De Niro, Charles Grodin, John Ashton, Yaphet Kotto, Dennis Farina, Philip Baker Hall, Joe Pantoliano, and company on screen. Today, our guests are performing excerpts from Charles Grodin's memoir, the incredible actor and voice acting legend, James Urbaniak, and the writer behind Midnight Run, George Gallo.
Oh boy. Jen Johans and I have been doing the Midnight Run Through project for some time now, and it's kind of crazy and an honor and totally overwhelming to finally ask this question to this person. George Gallo, why are you so unpopular with the Chicago Police Department? Thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure. And the answer is, you know, that really doesn't concern you. Wasn't that his response?
It's the beginning of like three or four responses over and again. But I think that's a level setter. If you're in a room and someone maybe mentions Midnight Run and you kind of overhear it, you sidle up to them, you just nudge them and say, why are you so unpopular with Chicago Police Department?
I'll tell you a crazy story. Do you want to hear a quick crazy story?
Yeah, of course. Of course. Okay. Always.
As I said prior to us starting, I despise flying, you know, which is one of the reasons why I wrote the movie, because I'd driven cross country so many times and taken trains. And, you know, if I had 3 days to get somewhere, I would take the Amtrak as opposed to flying, because every time I got on a plane, it just took like a year off my life. So I just said, you know, I'm not doing that. So I'd rather just get on the train and have a couple of drinks and wake up, look out the window. Oh, look at that. That's Albuquerque. And have some dinner, fall back asleep and look out the window. Oh, look, that's Chicago. So anyway, but I was in Union Station across from Union. I was switching trains. I was coming from New York to Chicago, and I had like 3-4 hours to kill. And there was a bar across the street. Now, this makes me sound like an alcoholic already, but there was a bar across the street, and I said, well, I might as well have a drink and get something to eat before I get on the train. And this is not made up. This story is totally true. I go to this bar. The place is basically empty. It's around 3-4 in the afternoon. There's a couple, three guys there at the far end of the bar. And one takes out a $20 bill and says, do the litmus configuration. And I said, holy shit, if these guys only knew, you know. And they started doing the bit. They run.
Oh, and my gosh.
And I said, hey, guys, you're doing it wrong. And they were a little hammered. They go, oh, what do you know? And I went, guys, I wrote the movie. And they were like, get out of here. Swear to God, I wrote the movie. Well, before you know it, I was very popular, and they bought me a round of drinks. So.
Fantastic. Fantastic.
Yeah. I was shocked. That really did happen.
God,
that's amazing.
You find good people everywhere, George. Even at a bar outside a train station late in the evening, you find good people. They're the kind of people that Jen and I are. We're doing the litmus configuration in the corner of a restaurant or a bar.
I'll tell you one other crazy story, because there's a million of them. I mean, if you don't mind.
Please.
I was with a friend of mine. We went back east. I was with a buddy of mine, and we were driving around, and he was from out here. And I said, hey, I want to see the house I grew up in Port Chester, New York. And, you know, I hadn't seen it like in probably 15, 20 years. And so we go, we start staring at the house. We look like we're casing the place, like we're going to rob it, you know, like thugs. So I said, I'll just go to the front door. And I went to the front door and I knocked. A really nice guy comes to the door. And I said, look, you know, he looked at me like I was selling something. I said, I grew up in this house. you know, and he went, oh, really? He will come in. So before, and I walked into that, I'll make the story quick. So I start talking to him, and they've got all these DVDs on the wall in the TV, and one of them was Midnight Run. And I was like, isn't that nuts? I grew up in this house, and then a movie that I wrote is on a DVD in this same house where I was a little kid, just dreaming of wanting to be a writer, you know? And so I thought that was sort of an interesting footnote or whatever you want to say.
That's amazing. It was one of the movies I watched the most as a kid. I was a weird kid, I guess. And I was a huge fan of Robert De Niro and had a crush on De Niro when I was in middle school. So you can imagine how popular I was with the Chicago Police Department and everyone. But I loved Midnight Run. And we've talked to so many people, like authors like Megan Abbott and William Boyle, who have memories that are similar. I remember seeing it all the time on HBO and quoting it, and you'd find other people who love the movie. So you wrote this thing that I think, you know, the alchemy, it kind of bonds all of us, and it's great.
I'm honored, and I wished I knew what I did. I just people have asked me, and I just sat down and wrote the movie I always wanted to see. That's really what I did.
It's so lovely, because even before we hit record, you just talking, some of your turns of phrase just bring a smile to my face, just the line of, you know, a friend of ours is now living in Pittsburgh, and you went, on purpose? And I just was like, that's the most George Gallo line. it's straight out of me. It's perfect, George.
Thank you. It was an acquired taste growing up in my neighborhood. So some of the guys in my, you know, it's funny, my dad who had didn't understand any of this stuff at all, like, oh, you want to be a writer, you know, what are you thinking, you know? Yeah, I'm gonna go to Hollywood, I'm gonna be a screenwriter. Yeah, sure. Anyway, but you know, when my dad saw the movie, he said, they paid you for that? Yeah. He goes, it was like listening to your horse shit for 2 hours. Oh. Well, yeah, that's pretty much what it was, Dad.
That's funny.
But he was very proud, but that he was just that guy.
Yeah. Well, Jen and I both, if there's one thing that we do separately and together, is voraciously read and research any project that we're on. And I found a wonderful interview with you and Mike Fury from some time back, where you were talking about, and I'd never read this before, so I had to talk to you now today about it, is that the relationship between Jack and the Duke, you said, was kind of like the way your parents talk to each other.
Based on my mother and father, that's true.
And I would love you to talk about that, because that, when I read that, it was like it unlocked something completely new. I was like, what is this? Why do I love this? It's just the, like, bickering, but from the place of love has always maybe been there. And I wasn't connecting the dots in the countless times I've watched Midnight Run.
Well, my father and mother were very different personalities. I mean, they loved each other very, very much, but there's a tremendous amount of, I would say, verbal sparring between. And trying to outsmart the other. And my father was more like the De Niro character in that he was very, very bright, but he was highly emotional. And he had a little bit of a hair trigger temper. It's like he was always like, you could push his buttons and he would smile on the first one. But by the second one, he was, you know, he's ready to throw punches. And my mother was a lot more like Charles Grodin. My mother was very intellectual, very quiet. And she was like a snake. She would just wait and then strike, you know. And she knew exactly what buttons to push in my dad. So my mother was far more like, yes, that's right, George. That's right. You know, I'm George Jr. And he goes, what are you trying? You being sarcastic? And I'm like, oh, no, why would I be sarcastic? You know, you're the greatest driver in the world, honey. You know, you should test drive for Lamborghini. Oh, God damn it. No, he'd start snapping, you know. So that kind of was their thing, you know. And as a kid growing up, listening to them, I would get just a kick out of it.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
And that really was a lot of where that all came from. And my father was great with wisecracks. you know, and so I picked a lot of that up, and that's really what I did. I wrote the two of them. I made it, you know, two men.
We began with 2 weeks rehearsal, which included virtually no rehearsal. Since Marty had seen Bob and me read the script over several times, he chose not to keep doing that. We all knew there would be improvisation used throughout and decided to hold it for the filming. The time was used carefully, going over the rather intricate script, being sure we all agreed just where each necessary piece of information was revealed. This is not usually done with the actors, but it had the effect of forging a unified team feeling about the whole picture that was unique. Robert De Niro had already been working on his role as a modern-day bounty hunter for some time. He had been going around on actual drug busts with teams of detectives, sometimes wearing a bulletproof vest as required. He had befriended a Los Angeles homicide detective who had killed several people in the line of duty and kept us regularly informed on the daily L.A. homicide rate. There were two shooting murders and a stabbing fatality downtown last night. De Niro had traveled to Chicago, since that's where his character had originally been a policeman, and went around with the police there, putting himself in Chicago danger. In my research for the role of the accountant who embezzles $15 million and gives it to charity, I placed one 10-minute phone call to my business manager, Ralph Goldman, to ask how such a transfer would technically be done. It was a pleasant chat. Bob De Niro and I remained cordial and slightly bemused toward each other. I think both of us were waiting for the other to reveal himself so that we could get a clearer sense of what this experience of just about being handcuffed to each other 6 days a week for 5 months was going to be like. It had to be a relationship, but what kind? Our first actual filming together was done late at night on a residential street in Brooklyn Heights. For about 4 hours, we shot a scene where he hustles me down the street and throws me into his car. He had just nabbed me upstairs in a house. I was to be handcuffed behind my back. In the picture, there were three kinds of handcuffs used: steel, rubber, and plastic. It was very dark. We were walking toward the camera, so you wouldn't actually see my hands in the shot. I suggested I just hold my hands behind my back and not use cuffs. Marty Brest suggested my arms would only look exactly right if I had cuffs on, rubber ones, since they wouldn't be seen. Bob asked if I would mind wearing the steel cuffs. I looked at him a moment, smiled, and said, "Sure." He smiled back. Neither of us knew what the other was thinking and didn't ask. A couple of hours later, having been taken on the walk to the car and thrown in by Bob about 15 times, I could really feel the cuffs on my skin, adding to the depth of my performance in the scene. Bob asked again if I minded. I said, "Not at all," and smiled again. So did he. I was enjoying the nonverbal repartee between us so much, I really didn't mind the cuff discomfort. Finally, at around 3 a.m., Marty felt it was as good as we could do it. Since I would be wearing handcuffs throughout the picture, I went home that night curious about what my wrists would look like in 4 months. I never saw that first night shooting, as it wasn't in the movie. We moved on to Chicago shortly to film a big shootout in a bus station in the heart of downtown. Bob and I would arrive on a bus, get off, and the FBI would come screeching up in several cars and spread-eagle us against the bus. Then the mob would start firing at us from nearby rooftops, and the FBI would shoot back at the mob. Explosions were going off for days. They weren't real bullets, but whatever they were, they could put your eye out. Bob and I went through some real jeopardy over the next few days, and like people who go through anything together, we grew closer. Not as close as I had hoped, though. The next shot called for Bob to drag me away in the confusion of the shootout, up a ramp, over a wall, under a truck, and into an empty police car, which he then steals. Bob thought it would be good to do it without rehearsal. Let the camera see what happens the first time we actually try it. We headed up the ramp, but since Bob is up every morning working out at 4:30, he moves a little faster than I do. As he pulled me up the ramp, We got some great realistic shouts of pain from me as the steel cuffs dug into my wrists. We got over the wall reasonably okay, although I quite sincerely improvised, "It's way too high." When he dragged me under the truck, I realized that unless I fell flat on my back, I would crack my head on the truck's underparts. Bob can crouch lower than I can too, so I quickly went on my back. He dragged me under the truck, threw me head over heels into a police car, and then sped away. At the end of the first take, he stopped the car and looked at me. "You okay?" he asked, with genuine concern. I looked at him for a long moment, and then said, "Let's talk." The only thing I felt I had to change was that we had to stay closer together with the handcuffs going up the ramp, in deference to my limited blood supply. The rest I felt I could do again. Just. We did the whole scene about 10 times more before we called it a day. I still have the scars.
I heard that you ran into Marty Brest, like you were coming out of Simpson's office and kind of just ran into him and gave him like an idea you were thinking of at the time, a bounty hunter. And how did all of that come about?
Yeah, that it's funny. I just told that story recently to somebody else. Look, this is why I definitely believe in the big guy upstairs. This was a total kind of a freak accident. I knew Marty pretty well. I'd met him a bunch of times and, you know, in that Hollywood hello, goodbye.
Yeah.
And I was a young writer. I'd just gotten out to LA from New York, I'd say four years earlier. And I got very lucky early on in that I came out with a couple, three scripts under my arm. And one of them was this movie Wise Guys that I had written. And the agent sent me on meetings and I sold Wise Guys to MGM and that movie got made.
So
the De Palma movie. So I had a little bit now, I guess, of a reputation as a young writer because I had a movie made. And I was 28 years old, 29.
Wow.
Yeah. And I started, and then I wrote, after Wise Guys, I wrote Bad Boys. I wrote that one first. It just sat around forever.
Wow.
Yeah. Gosh. And I sold originally to Paramount and then it wanted to turn around to Sony. But I had a meeting in Bruckheimer's office, and it was actually with Simpson, who was completely nuts, but a great guy. And,
that's good.
You know, yeah, he just loved movies. He loved movies. Mm. Loved movies. You don't see too many guys like that today. I mean, this guy just lived movies. And, you know, today, a lot of the people I meet with, they have a film history of 18 months, you know.
Yeah.
And a lot of times if you start talking about The Exorcist their eyes glaze over. They've heard mm-hmm. it. They don't really know it.
Our eyes glaze over when we're like, oh my God, we're here to talk about Midnight Run, but we could probably do 3 hours on De Palma. Like we both just we've got a friend who's one of our dearest friends is writing a book on De Palma and we literally heard his head explode somewhere in the universe in LA. Wow. And we're like, wow. Oh my God, okay, let's get back to the topic at hand, which is your history.
Right. So then back to Midnight Run. So I was meeting with Simpson and I had, I left my car keys in the office. So then I walked back to get the car keys and then I came out and it was perfect timing. So this is why, like I say, I believe in kismet or whatever. There was Marty Brest walking through the parking lot and he goes, "Hey, Georgie, what are you working on? What are you doing?" I says, "Well, I just finished this thing, Bad Boys," which originally was called Bulletproof Hearts. And he goes, "Yeah, I read it. They gave it to me," because he had directed Beverly Hills Cop for them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So he was love that movie.
Yeah, it's great. And he was their go-to guy, you know, for anything in that genre. And he said, "Yeah, I read it. It's really good." He goes, "I just don't want to do two cop movies." Mm-hmm. And he said, "Well, what else you got?" And I said, "I'm working on this bounty hunter thing." And he goes, "What, a Western?" I said, "No, they have bounty hunters, present-day bounty hunters," which wasn't that much in the zeitgeist then, you know? And he goes, well, what do you got? Tell me the story. I says, "Well, I got about 53 pages in the car," which I used to type on an IBM Selectric, and then I'd make notes all over it and I would drive all around with it in a folder, you know, and I would work on it in coffee shops. I said, "I happen to have it in the car." So I went, he goes, "Well, let me read it." I said, "It's not finished." He goes, "Oh no, I want to read it. I want to read it." So I went to the car, I gave him the pages. He went into his office And then I waited around the lot. I started, you know, talking to people. Mm-hmm. One guy was Waylon Green, the screenwriter, yes. Wrote Wild Bunch and wow. Sorcerer, you know, Sorcerer of the Billy Friedkin movie. So he was a buddy. So I talked to him, and then about an hour and change later, I went over to Marty's office, and Marty said, "How does it end?" I says, "I don't know." I says, I just know he lets him go in the end. That's all I know. And he goes, "I want to do this." I went, oh. "Okay, you're not going to get any argument from me." But so he goes, "We'll finish it." I went, "Okay." So then I finished it, and the rest is history.
And I read you were inspired by reading about a real mob accountant who didn't know he was working for the mob. And
yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's true. I'm always reading stuff, you know. And it's always that would make a good movie, or that would make a good movie, or that's an interesting situation. I mean, most of the things I think that become movies or things that you end up writing about, they're not because you were searching for something. It's some offhanded comment somebody makes. Yes. Like on Midnight Run, I'll tell you where Midnight Run came from. I was having lunch with a cop, great guy named Stanley White. And he was my tech advisor on Bad Boys, and we got to be buddies. So we were having lunch on Sunset Boulevard. And he said to me that he had to go to Florida. He had to fly to Florida to pick up a prisoner and bring him back to Los Angeles. He mm-hmm. said, but the effing guy won't get on a plane. I said, "What do you mean?" I said right away, ding, 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 ding.
Yeah.
"What do you mean?" He goes, "Well, if the prisoner doesn't want to fly, it's against his civil rights for me to force him onto an airplane. So I have to drive back from Florida with this effing guy." And I said, "Well, what's that like?" He goes, "Well, you know, you're alone. You know, it's me and another cop and him, the perp." And he goes, "And over time, you start talking the way any three guys would in a car."
Yeah.
"And you're stuck for 5 days. So you talk about everything. You talk about wives, girlfriends, things you wished you could do differently." And I said, "Man, there's a movie in here somewhere." And that's how it started. And then I said, "Well, I've seen cops to death, maybe." And then I started reading about bounty hunters, and I said, "Well, that's an interesting take. Maybe it's a bounty hunter." So that's mm-hmm. that's where that came from.
That's great. My favorite line with that scene is, "These things go down," the way that Charles Grodin keeps it's so good.
Well, that's completely my neurosis about flying, you know. It's too big. It can't go.
Yeah. That's the other line. It's too big.
It's too big.
Oh, man. How much was it in the script? Like what you wrote wound it up, or why it was on the screen? I mean, how did that work?
I mean, I was on the set every day, which that became my film school too. I said to Marty, I said, "Look, I'm not going to say shit. I just sit there and watch this happen and watch the acting and how you, because I want to direct myself." And so I just watched everything. And some of the stuff that was not in the script, I would watch them work. And then De Niro would always say, give me something. Mm-hmm. So I'd throw something out, you know, like, it's a $10 fine for jaywalking in Los Angeles. That came to me right off the top of my head, because they dragged him and took him across the street. And he goes, give me something. So there was a lot of...
God, I can't imagine for a young writer to be there on that set with those guys. I mean, so when Marty grabs it and you've learned that De Niro is going to be in it, was it as big a deal in 1988 that you're working with De Niro? I mean, you just come off of, you know, selling something to De Palma. You've got this amazing script, Bad Boys, which becomes a decade defining action movie in the following decade. And you've got here, you've got Marty Brest, the biggest action director at the time, making your movie. How many out of body experiences were there on that set for you?
You know, I'll tell you the God's honest truth. I don't think it's always different than you think it's going to be. You know, I remembered, to answer your question, I remembered when I was younger, just the idea of seeing your name on a movie screen written and directed by, you know, what that would be. And the very first time I saw my name on a movie screen, was on Wise Guys, and I sat there in a theater watching it with a bunch of people. I didn't even know where my credit was going to be. And when it came up, I thought I was going to go, oh, like that, you know? And I didn't. I literally ducked. I thought my head, and I was like, oh shit, that didn't just happen. It's almost like I didn't want to believe it. And yeah, with this, working with all these guys, and working with Marty and all the actors, I think I was, you know, sometimes I think fear and excitement sometimes feel very much alike.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I was always somewhere between this can't be happening. I'm scared that this is going to fall apart. But yet I am here and they are taking me seriously for some reason. You know, looking back on it, and when I think about it, it's and now that we know what the movie became and how people responded to it, I'm obviously ecstatic. It was one of the great high points of my life, you know, but I think at the time I was just more involved with the day to day of it, you know, and not quite believing it.
Yeah. And De Niro at the time was known more for serious roles. So when they first floated his name, were you thinking, what is this? Or just, oh my gosh, it's like the greatest actor ever attached to my script.
I thought both things. I mean,
yeah,
I found out on a Friday. I mean, I remember exactly where I was. And Marty and I were talking, and he said, De Niro is going to play Jack Walsh. And I was like, what? He goes, yeah, Robert De Niro. He's going to play Jack Walsh. And I was like, wow. Okay. You know, I mean, look, the guy's this genius actor, you know?
Yeah.
And he and I became very, very dear friends. I couldn't believe it. I went over to my buddy, who had a little coffee shop, and I went over to see him. I said, you're not going to believe this shit, but I just, Robert De Niro was going to do Midnight Run. And he was like, what? You know? So yeah, it was a crazy time. And I was just dating Julie at the time. And eventually we've been married now forever. Mm-hmm. But we were just dating. It was a wonderful time in my life. I was, you know, a young guy and, you know, very naive in a lot of ways. And anyway, yeah.
That's
with each
great.
Passing year, with each passing year, it gets better, you know?
Yeah. And I know they were trying to push, especially at Martin Brest, like share. And I heard you in an interview say something like, what is De Niro going to say? I'm going to, you know, flush your head in a toilet.
Yeah.
To share.
I said, so, so I went to see, you know, because Marty and I were inseparable, you know?
Yeah.
He said, share. He goes, would that work? I mean, I could tell he didn't dig it, you know?
Yeah.
Would that work? I said, yeah, Robert De Niro is going to say to share, if you don't shut your mouth, I'm going to stick your fucking head in the toilet bowl.
Make it stay there.
He went, you're right. God, it's terrible.
Totally different movie. I also love all the character actors in there. I mean, did you start, you said you were on the set and probably, you know, De Niro was asking you for lines, but you have somebody like Joe Pantoliano saying your dialogue, and did it change the way it sounded?
Farina.
Yes.
Yafet Kota.
They were all brilliant.
John Ashton is so good.
Yeah, Yafet Kota was my idea. I said that to
Mark. Oh, good.
I said, you know what? He goes, who do you see for Mosley? I said, I see Yafet. He's so big. He's so threatening. And I don't think he's all that funny. And because he's like this angry block of cement, he's even more funny.
He's 100 times funnier than you could ever even wish it for him to be. Yes. He's so
just
funny
saying,
in this movie.
I'm Mosley.
I'm Mosley.
Yeah.
The best.
We'll be right back after this quick break.
George, Jen and I have this thing where we seem to be drawn to these movies because, you know, we have enduring relationships with them, and Midnight Run is one that we've really connected over in our friendship because we have such an affinity for that time in De Niro's career particularly, but we really love this movie. And I just wonder if I'm always curious if, as a filmmaker, you realize when there's like, it starts to bubble up and simmer up and be one of those movies that cuts through. Because one of the things that we have now, contemporary times, is there are so many movies that come out. There are so many platforms. There are so, you know, such an international footprint. All this stuff comes out and it's impossible to catch everything. And then I find myself like just out of comfort, mostly going back to these great things. And when I watch Midnight Run, or I watch contemporary movies and I go back and watch Midnight Run, I'm always just floored to this day that like how damn good it is, how everything is good, how your script is phenomenal, how the actors are tremendous, how Marty Brest's direction is just outlandishly great. All the locations are so beautiful. And I just say, I wonder, because now it feels like for us that Midnight Run is, especially amongst our friend group and our peers and our connections, or it's so well loved. But I wonder, like, was there a time that it sort of hit at the time that it was released? But when did you start noticing that it really had a stranglehold in culture? Because you've been part of a couple of massive movies that have had like a stranglehold on culture for X amount of time. Like Bad Boys had like a decade, you know, of this massive decade from 95. Of having this huge pop culture influence. And I just wonder, like, when did you feel like with Midnight Run, people like us started, you know, whooping in audiences and those sorts of things? And when did it start to sort of change for you? Or has it always been there?
That's a great question. I remember the first time I saw it with an audience, because, you know, there's a lot of nerves involved in it. And people were just hysterical and applauding.
It's great.
Like you're overwhelmed. I was overwhelmed, you know, because, you know, like I come from a very working class family, and you know, I'm a billion miles away from Hollywood, and I just lived with all of this, you know, this stuff in my head for a very long time as a young man, you know, wanting to do this, and you convince yourself that you're terrific because, you know, and it's you just do it to if no one believes in you, you know, the first person that has to believe in you is you.
Yeah.
Because you're going to get hit with every curve imaginable, you know, trying to do this. So obviously I believed in myself, but then when it starts to happen and you really are, your work is now going out into the world, you start to realize that a lot of that stuff was bullshit and bravado, and you would just keep yourself, you know, going and keep. And then suddenly you're like, well, maybe I suck, you know. Maybe I was just telling myself a whole bunch of shit to get here. And when I heard the audiences just howling and laughing, and I would go to sneak into theaters, and the places were packed, and they would just laugh and laugh and laugh. I would get very emotional and very choked up. And then the next question was, could I ever do this again? You know, but that's also a bad question to ever ask yourself, because whatever happened with Midnight Run is something magical. And, you know, like a director could make 50 movies, and if one of them is a classic or two of them are classics, that's an amazing batting average, you know?
Yes.
Yeah.
And as a writer, you know, the worst thing you can do is, or as Waylon Green actually said to me, he said, don't ever believe your reviews. He said, don't believe the bad ones. You're not that bad. And don't believe the good ones, because you're certainly not that good. He said, you know, so don't get caught up in that shit and just keep trying to tell the truth, you know, to the best of your ability.
Absolutely. You said you always were interested in films and filmmaking from a young age. Were there, did you have a first favorite movie that kind of set you on this path?
You know, a first favorite movie. Well, you ask great questions. you know, I'm also a painter. I think you know that, right?
Yeah, local color, which is great.
Thanks. And anything with the arts or music, you know, I learned a whole bunch of musical instruments. Anything with the arts, I just gravitated to, which is, you know, I'm a big guy. I'm 6'4", you know.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as sports go, I was the all-time worst. Like if you threw a ball at me.
Same, tall and just uncoordinated, yes.
Like if you threw a ball at me, I would be like, oh, fuck, you know, please. What do I do now, you know? But writing, directing, give me a guitar, I'll figure it out. Those things just came naturally to me. Mm-hmm. But a first movie, you know, I didn't know that I wanted to make them, but I remember the first time I saw The Treasure of Sierra Madre with my
Wow.
And I said to myself, God, what a trip you go on with that movie.
Yes.
What an amazing journey. And then they say goodbye to each other, and they'll never see each other again. Those mm-hmm. two guys, they ride off in different directions, and that music swells, and you know, so that obviously it touched me very, very much, and it stayed with me. And then I remember as a kid, I saw It's a Mad, 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 Mad World in the theater.
Oh, yes.
With my mother and father, and I'd never seen anything like that in my life. Those mm-hmm. car crashes and planes flying through billboards. And I was like, that, you know, obviously those coals were already being stoked, you know?
Yeah.
But then around, it was a great time in American cinema, you know, like around 1970, which puts me at around 14, 15 years old. Mm-hmm. You know, out comes The Godfather and The French Connection and Serpico, and then Dog Day Afternoon and Mean Streets. And, it was like the filmmaker had a voice. It was like a true artist. And I love Sidney Pollack. Sidney Pollack.
Me too. One of my favorites. Yeah.
Sorry.
Oh, what? No. Please go, Josh.
Sidney was a good friend of mine. He gave me the greatest advice. I've said this in other interviews, but I got to know him very well. He kept going, he goes, "You're a funny guy. You're a funny son of a bitch, George." When I got a chance to direct my first movie, 29th Street, I said, "Sidney, you got to give me some pointers." He said, "Get good shoes." I went, "What?"
Oh, yes.
He says, "Your feet are going to kill you by day two, day three." He says, "You think I'm kidding?" He says, "Get good shoes." I went, "Okay, what else?" He says, "Don't be afraid to let the movie become what it wants to be." And I went, "Huh." And his whole thing was, you've got the screenplay and you've got the actors and, you know, but the movie is not going to be the script. The movie's going to be something else. And mm-hmm. he said, "So if you're getting a laugh, if you're seeing something working, if you're seeing some magic happen," he said, "don't be afraid to chase that." Yeah. He said, don't say, "Oh, I can't do that because that won't work because blah, blah, blah." He said, "Don't be afraid to chase those things because mm-hmm. allow the movie to be what it wants to be." And I often think, because I came from an art background, that's also very true about painting. You know, a lot of times you're working on something and you lay down a color and it's not at all what you had in your head. You mm-hmm. go, oh. So, but to say, "That looks pretty," or "That looks interesting. Maybe I could do this." And then suddenly you and the painting are having a dialogue. And it's the same thing when you're making a film. You try to have a dialogue with it. You go, "Oh, okay." I hope I'm not babbling too much.
It's wonderful.
When you were talking about guitar, George, because I dabble sometimes with guitar, and I usually sometimes just sit there and pluck my guitar while I'm watching a movie, you know, just like mindlessly tinker on scales going back and forth. And as you said, sometimes it's like you're playing the notes on a song that you know, and you mess up something and it sounds mm-hmm. great, and you go, "Well, that sounds great." Like, you just, it's just an accident. It's like, oh,
I think most things come from that. I mean, yeah. A lot of medical breakthroughs come from that.
Yes.
You know, they were trying to fix one thing and they grew hair, you know?
yeah.
Then, you know, the same thing, you know, you see, there was a famous chef. I don't know which chef it was. I read very recently. He says, "I don't make mistakes in the kitchen. I just create new recipes."
I love that. Yeah.
God, I actually think that if I was looking for the Venn diagram of what Midnight Run is, it is the mixture of A Mad, 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 Mad World and Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Sierra Madre, a little bit. You can kind of see that.
You can see that. You can see it so clearly now that you said it, George.
And I'll tell you another thing. There was another movie that I'm sure you guys know it. The original Taking of Pelham 1, 2, 3.
Oh, oh yeah. Love that film.
Love it.
It's in my absolute top five, you know, for me. Mm-hmm. It so caught what New York City was at that time. And it, it, And there are some references to that movie in Midnight Run. Mm. I'll tell you what they are. There's a line in the Taking of Pelham 1-2-3 where he says, $2, $2. I wish there were $2. It's $1 million. It's a one with six zeros.
And there you go.
I did that in Midnight Run. It's a one with six zeros. And then there's another one when De Niro is on the phone and he says, Harold Longman, please. Do you remember that when he's getting that phone number?
Yeah.
Harold Longman's name was mentioned once in Pelham 1-2-3. It was the character that Martin Balsam played. So,
That's amazing.
Yeah, so
that is so good. I love these tidbits. I love them.
Okay. Well, then he says, say hello to Julie for me. And that's my wife's name, Julie.
Oh, that's good.
And I'm the cab driver at the end of the movie. Did you know that?
I did not.
No, I didn't.
Looks like I'm walking. Wow.
Yeah. At the end of the movie when he goes, you got change of 1,000? Yeah, that's my voice. What are you, a comedian? Get out of here.
That's great.
That is that's a cameo for the ages, George.
Thank you.
That's a cameo for the ages.
What was it like? I know Charles Grodin came later. He was ripping off De Niro and you were watching that. What was the whole process of casting the perfect person there to be De Niro's foil like?
Well, Marty has something that I don't have. You know, Marty has patience and I'm not a very patient person sometimes. Like he will read 20,000 actors, you know, and I've directed, you know, what, 14, 15 movies. After 10, I want to rip my eyeballs out, you know. And he just takes his time and takes his time and takes his time. And so we met with every actor in Hollywood because you have to remember Robert De Niro he's still Robert De Niro, you know, but
yeah.
I'm saying at that time he was at his probably most mythic.
Yes.
Place in his career, and every actor who read that script wanted to be handcuffed to him for an entire movie.
Yes,
you know, if you think,
you're with him in every single scene. You know, and so everybody came in red. I mean, Bruce Willis came in red, and and then he went off and did Die Hard, which opened the same day as us.
I heard that. Yes,
and they beat us at the box office.
Oh.
Yeah, but
just another little movie in competition, as you said, a bit of a purple patch in American cinema, just a little movie called Die Hard, you know.
Yeah. And you know what's crazy? They were afraid of us. I didn't know this because Marty later told me that they were caught because they knew that Midnight Run had tested through the roof. They kept doing these previews all over the country and they kept testing like 95, 97, 98, you know, these insane numbers. So they didn't want to release Die Hard the same day as us, and but there was no turning back. It was that's the it was locked in, and I think they beat us by $2 million that weekend.
Gotcha.
Well, so when Charles Grodin is actually there, you're on set watching him, and Marty's patience pays off. Like, did you ever have a moment where you were like, "Oh, he's so much different, but maybe perfect"? Because that's the thing, you know, we've talked about how hilarious this movie is and how quotable it is and how fun it is, but oh man, the emotional center of this thing, that the more treasure of this Sierra Madre in the terms of our conversation, in the framing of our conversation moments of this movie, I feel like that's the stuff that like knocks me out now that I go back to it so frequently, especially for this project, is just how good he is, how good they are. When Jack goes and visits his wife and his daughter, those moments of the movie just level me, George. Like, and I'm usually one moment I'm cackling and the next moment I'm welling up. And I just wonder, like, when did you know, like you said, the alchemy we talked about before, this alchemy of this movie, when did you know that that alchemy was just crazy?
I'd love to bullshit you and, oh, I saw it from day one, you know, but you know, the truth be told, I didn't know. I'll tell you when I started to feel it. Look, when I watched them working together on set, you could sense, let's put it this way. I caught myself laughing a lot and I believed everything I was seeing.
That's good.
But which is always the best. Do I believe it? Do I believe it? And I was so happy that nobody was mugging it up and being silly.
Yeah.
You know, but just playing it all straight. And so I had an idea, you know, but then again, I did not have the opportunity of seeing anything I'd written except one other time, mm-hmm. you know, be put together, you know, and I kept thinking to myself, I sure hope the story's going to work. I sure hope it's not too complicated, because it is a fairly complicated movie. It's all based on backstory. You know, it's all based on relationships, and is it going to seem too much exposition, you know, because there is a fair amount of exposition in the movie. But
just to be fair to you, like you said, you put, you know, from that inspiration of this story of your tech advisor, you put a couple of guys in a car for 5 days, they're going to start talking. And what
you're
are you talking about?
You're going to get exposition. It's
the mode of the movie. The function of the movie is you're going to sit there and start talking about stuff, and you're going to want to penetrate deeper than that passive, you know, like little, you know, airplane, you know, what do you call it? Like David Fincher called it in Fight Club, you know, those throwaway, those single serve, you know, friendships over one flight. 5 days is different to an hour.
Yeah, and Charles Grodin in his memoir actually said, I mean, he was in Heartbreak Kid, he was in other things, and he liked those roles, but he said this was the role, the three-dimensional, like the most three-dimensional and human character he had played, and he still considered for years that this was like the best character. And so you have to think about that, yeah, you really did make everyone human. Yeah,
there's also a sense of, you know, for me personally, you know, one of my picadillos, or you know, I'm highly sentimental.
Yeah.
And my wife said, I'm so sentimental, I can miss 5 minutes ago. You know? Julie said that. But, you know, there is a sense of that in the movie, in that these two guys meet under very trying circumstances and really do grow to love and respect each other.
Sometimes in chase sequences, the car with the actors is towed by a camera car. I like it that way because the other way, the actor is actually driving the car around hairpin curves or wherever. In this case, the actor driver was De Niro. Before beginning the movie, I had read a magazine article about Bobby in which Shelley Winters was quoted as saying she was terrified in a movie she had done with Bob when he was at the wheel of a car. I saw myself as someone a little more easily terrified than Shelley Winters, so my head really shot up when I heard that today Bob would be at the wheel in a desperate getaway attempt. I will take no credit for any acting in those chase scenes. A guy who goes on real-life drug busts wearing a bulletproof vest also drives a car at top speeds as he's trying to get away. The man made no concession to anything. Confronted with that much dedication to reality, I couldn't bring myself to say, take it easy or slow down, but expressed myself again through improvisation with some pretty good heartfelt attacks on him. He had earlier proven that he could gain and lose 100 pounds or so, but nowhere in the deserved great actor literature on De Niro does it say he's a great driver. I would rate the whole chase experience as a little worse than being shot at. We had an outstanding supporting cast on the picture, including an odd couple more odd than Bob and I. The mob boss was played by Dennis Farina, who was actually an ex-Chicago police detective turned actor. One of his two henchmen was played by Richie Ferrangi, an ex-convict turned actor. Both men are extremely talented. Richie, about 20 years ago, had served time in Sing Sing and Attica, among other places, for robbery. He had turned away from that life simply because he was tired of serving time. Quote, if you can't do the time, don't do the crime, unquote. It was fascinating to watch the ex-cop, Dennis, watch the ex-con, Richie, talk about his past. Kind of like a cat and mouse who had called a truce. Richie told me that the best thing you could possibly rob, should you ever be interested, is a trailer truck full of razor blades. When I looked uncomprehendingly at him, he explained, "Do you realize how many razor blades you could put in a trailer truck?" There was an elderly man I had seen walking around the streets of Williams, Arizona, where we were to shoot a scene in which Bob and I pretend to be FBI agents in order to claim some phony $20 bills in a bar so that we can get some money for food. I first saw the man as Bob and I were driving through the town on the way to the bar. I learned he was with us, an extra, and asked that when we do the bar scene, he be placed on a stool next to me for some possible improvisation. He looked very much at home on a bar stool in the morning, nursing a drink and sucking on a cigarette. I told him that in the middle of the scene, I was going to look at him suspiciously and ask if he'd seen any suspicious characters around here. We were supposedly looking for a ring of counterfeiters. He was to simply say no. Then I said I'd ask him if he lived around here. He was then to say yes, and I would look at him with extreme suspicion. We incorporated it into the first take. Marty Brest and everyone else loved how he did it. As the day wore on, I suggested to him more dialogue to do with me. At one point, I told him I'd ask him if he'd ever done any time in prison. He was to say yes. I'd look at him accusingly and ask what was the charge, and he was to say murder, but I didn't do it. After that, the guy was being celebrated as the hot new find of the picture. Everyone thought he was making up his lines on the spot. By the end of the day, I think he was receiving more applause and approval than he'd gotten in his previous 80 years. But suddenly all the attention seemed to be too much. He had an uncontrollable coughing fit. His blood pressure shot sky high, and he had to be raced to the hospital, all the while resisting. "I want to work. I want to work." I later learned that, although he looked 80, he was the same age I was. The next day, he was back on his stool to finish out the sequence.
During this trip, even though they were complete odds with each other.
Yeah.
And, so I have that tendency, you know, when they say goodbye at the end, it's one of those moments that they'll just never see each other again.
Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah.
And that this will probably be the most intense week of, they'll both remember it till,
yep,
till they shut their eyes, you know? And, yeah. So I think about those things when I'm working. I think a lot of it is, unfortunately, I don't find a lot of that in movies today. I don't find deep human connections. And I think part of the problem is the people who are younger, who are writing these things. There's two issues, if I could go off on a tangent. The one issue is, I notice this a lot in younger people, where I'll say, like when I had younger assistants, you know, a few of them have become screenwriters in their own right. But I would say, hey, let's call so-and-so. And he goes, you can see right away, panic. And I say, well, what did I say? Let's call him up. You know, and he goes, well, why don't we just text him? I want to hear his voice. I'd rather go see him personally. I want to smell him. I want to know what he looks. I want to hear when I ask him a question. Does he dodge? Does he? Texting. I'm thinking I could shape things. The hell with that shit. I want human contact. Mm-hmm. And I find that a lot of people today, they text. You're not going to learn shit about a person texting, okay? You know, mm-hmm. You're texting, it's not you, it's your representative.
Yeah.
So there's none of that, human beings are at their best when they're broken in some way, when they're tired, when they're not, when they're more themselves, I guess, when they're mm-hmm. truly their authentic selves. That's and those connections to me are lost in a lot of movies today. And I think sometimes it gets misread as sentimentality, but I don't think it is at all. I think it's an appreciation for being alive, because it's all over too fucking quick. And
yeah.
And the other thing is, if you want to be a screenwriter, if you want to be a director, you have to go to the well. You have to look at the great films to say,
oh yeah,
I want to be a painter. And who's this Picasso guy? You don't want to be a painter.
But, yeah.
You got to look at Picasso and Matisse, and you got to, and Edward Redfield, the American Pennsylvania Impressionist, and George Wesley Bellows, and John Singer Sargent, and John Constable. You got to look at these people, and Monet and Renoir. You got to eat this shit up, you know. And
yeah,
to be a musician, and you got to listen to everything, man. The jazz, the Beatles, the Stones, you know, blues. You got to listen to everything, and if you don't know who these people are, then you're full of shit, you know.
Yeah.
And also, like you said, sometimes it's the tactile experience, you know. Like on 2 points, my friends hate that I call, and I call all of them. I hate texting. I hate it to this day.
Yeah.
A couple of times, like my wife, like very early on when we were just dating, she would sometimes like ask a series of questions in texts.
Right.
And a couple of times, like in a probably more hostile way, I maybe softened a little bit as I've gotten older, but I was like, fucking call me would be my three texts. I'm right. Not answering 50 questions. Just call me. We can have a 10 minute conversation. It's over.
Yeah.
This is a pop quiz. What is this? Like, I want to have a dialogue with a human being.
And the other thing is, like you said, it's, you know, when you read the books and you consume the painting, sometimes also it's just like, I remember some of the most affecting experiences in my life. I was in Paris and I saw a Monet up close and I was like, oh my God, like you can see the waves in the oil and you're like, Jesus, like I get, like, it's like, there's something there. You're experiencing something. You're making an impression on your life and how you think about art in a completely different way.
Because all the arts
and all of it.
That's what's important too, is if you're a filmmaker, don't just stick with films, read, do other things, listen to music, you know, it's like life, go out there, call people. Yes.
Call people.
Well, but you can't get, look, maybe people feel like they lose control. But you're not in control. Control is a myth. So give it up.
Very much. Yeah.
Okay. A rock would come out of the sky and hit you right in the fucking head. And then it's you can't control shit. So just stop going there and, you know, engage, you know?
Yeah.
I remember what we were talking about. I remember when I met him for the very first time, and I met him simultaneously with Marty. Marty was in the room and I was there. And then Robert De Niro walks in, and I have a habit. You know, and I make fun of it. My wife makes fun of it. When I get nervous, I can literally verbalize my worst thought out loud. and I've done it a couple times at the most inopportune times. But I remember I did it this one time. De Niro walks in and he shakes hands with Marty. And Marty says, "This is George Gallo." And I shook hands with him. I'm like, "I just shook hands with Robert De Niro." And the first effing thing that comes out of my mouth, I said, "Why do you want to do this?" I swear to God that's what happened. And Bob recoiled and started laughing. And Marty gave me a look like the look of death. I mean, daggers coming out of his eyes, you know. But Bob and I became very good friends right after that because he knew I was certainly unpolished, you know.
Anyway, you're genuine.
Yeah, I suppose.
The best.
Well, we're really happy and honored to be engaging with you, George.
Thank you so much. This is a
treat.
Our hearts are very full today, George. Thanks to this. This is just such it's a delight. So rare things are a delight, but you are delightful, and this is a delightful conversation. And we are so honored.
Tell my wife. I think she forgets.
Tell mine.
I will.
Say hi to Julie for me.
Yes,
say hi to Julie. So.
This has been the finale of Midnight Run Through with Jen Johans and Blake Howard. And there's only one way to go out.
See you in the next life.